The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and our guest this morning on The Breakfast Grill is Dato' Abdul Majid Khan, former Malaysian Ambassador to China and President of the Malaysia-China Friendship Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Dato', because you have a very long CV and we'd spend too much time just going through it, so I'm going to cut to the chase in terms of the big question that's being asked, and it's a global question, but it's also a question that's being asked locally and perhaps a little politicized, which is that, is our relationship with China increasingly one where we are at the losing end? Are we in danger of being dominated by China because of its economic heft, because of its political heft in the region?
I think, our relations with China should be given a wider perspective. I think first we should realize that, China is a very important country to Malaysia, economically and geopolitically. And I think following China's own modernization, it has emerged as the second largest economy. This is very important to us as a trading nation. And you see, all over the years, last 42 years, when we established diplomatic relations with China, we have managed the relation very well. And I think we have benefited from this relation. We started zero base with China in 1970s. Particularly, there is no content in our bilateral relation. Today, we have actually cooperation and partnership in all sectors. And recently, in the last 5-6 years, we have seen an accelerated Chinese investment coming to Malaysia. I think these are all important hallmark of the achievement that we have managed with China. And I think these have benefited us. So
as you put a very positive spin on this, there is, of course, and I'm sure you recognize, quite a bit of either skepticism or worry just because China is so big, just because there is a history in which, and this is kind of implied, that China is the dominant partner, benign or otherwise, it's still the dominant partner. You were first there in the 80s, a very different China from the 90s when you were there as an ambassador. You were there when China was under the leadership of Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, some time before the emergence of the current leadership of Xi Jinping. But tell us about that time. Tell us about the 80s first.
Let me go back to the concern. I think this concern is quite universal. Basically, it's because of the size of China. And also in the early years, because of the uncertainty of the Chinese policy. But I think the Chinese have made it known that, they would like to play a wider and bigger role internationally. And also, I think economically, they have started several initiatives. I think we need to respond to this because I think we can gain benefit. As to the future intention, I think basically we manage China according to our own rules and regulation. We must have own governance. We must have our own guideline. This way, then, China, we can protect our interests while developing relations with China.
But okay, so let's take a step back and draw in terms of your personal experience of China, because it's a unique one. You went there as a diplomat, as a young diplomat in the 80s. China just emerging through the reforms that Deng Xiaoping had put in into the four modernizations and such. Did you think, if you cast your mind back to the 80s, that China would and its growth would be so accelerated that it would be in a position now to rival the United States of America?
I think at that moment, for most of us, the China watchers or those who have the luck to be at the front line of this transformation, I think we have never imagined that China could emerge with such a speed. Basically, at that period, in the early 80s, China was just beginning to open up, and you can see from a poor country, isolated, without friends, China within 34 years has emerged as the second largest economy, has actually extended its influence globally, and are part of the larger international community.
Where do you think it comes from? I mean, you interacted with, ordinary Chinese people, with also the leadership, with other diplomats. What was driving China to achieve this?
I would say four factors. First, the leadership. During Mao's period, it was chaos, and I think the country was really down. I think Deng Xiaoping came up with this vision. So with his leadership, he steered actually a new direction for China. Secondly, he put in place a very appropriate strategy. You know, this famous, you know, saying, it doesn't matter whether the cat is white or black, it catches mouse, you know. So the ideological aspect of it is just being shelved out, you know. And thirdly, the implementation. I think Chinese bureaucrats have done well to actually implement the strategy that has been in place by the leadership. And finally, if I notice this even today, the Chinese people are full of entrepreneurial spirit. I think they were ashamed. Being a big civilization, 5,000 years, they were poor, they were looked down, and people have described China as a sick man of Asia, you know. So there's a big, strong urge to be rich, to be part of the world. You know, then they felt humiliated over the 100 years under colonialism, and also, you know, they were treated by the colonial powers badly. So these factors, I think, push China to what it is today.
Now, you know, that's a very interesting point of segue also into the current leadership of Xi Jinping, especially kind of after the 19th Party Congress. And, you know, and Xi Jinping also talking about this idea, and I think the phrase is, you know, China dreams. Do you think there is that pride, this pride of taking a leadership role in the world is animating or pushing China more aggressively to assert itself globally? And where do we stand in terms of that? Especially if we look at, for instance, the South China Sea and the assertion of the nine dash line hypothesis of ownership of this vast body of water. We have, in some ways, and ASEAN, I'm going to talk about that, of course, because of your role in ASEAN as well, not been able to push back on China's assertion. Where do we stand? I mean, how do we deal with a China that now is making arguments like the nine dash line?
I think basically, you know, what happened after the 19th Congress, to me, this is a second, you know, revolution that you can call. The first revolution was the open door, which actually was targeted to bring investment, to bring the outside world into China. And for 34 years, they have actually accomplished what they want. Became wealthy, became a capital export country. They are all over the world today in terms of investment, trade, and also political influence. So after the 19th Congress, you can see this assertiveness. And it's interesting. In the past, the Chinese are a bit shy about their role globally. But it's interesting at this party, they clarify the strategic direction. And I think they are going to do this through their so-called Road and Bridge Initiative, you know, BRI. So coming to this dispute in South China Sea, I think our position has been very clear. On the principle of it, I think, you know, we stand firm on the international law and also related to legal processes. But in the practicality of it, I think we have adopted a non-confrontational approach to China because we are neighbours. And we think the best would be to have dialogue and also to talk. And I think there's a framework, conduct COC, which the Chinese now have agreed. So perhaps through this framework, the dispute, I don't think it can be resolved. But I think basically to reduce the tension and to become come to a better understanding, because the final objective is to make the region a region of peace and prosperity. And I think China has to contribute to this, and also ASEAN countries and the region.
You were Director General at ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, for a period. Many people look at ASEAN's inability to have a joint position, or it took so long for them to have a joint position on the South China Sea. In the meantime, you say, there's a policy of accommodation and understanding and dialogue. At the same time, China is building on reefs. It is claiming that these islands, it's ignored international tribunal decisions that have shown them to be in the wrong, at least in terms of international law. Is this a kind of losing game? Or do we just have to say that China's here to stay? It is going to assert itself. And the best thing is to maintain a good relationship. There is no point in nation states, especially small and medium-sized nation states like our own, to push back and use international law as such. I mean, the Philippines failed, essentially, to assert itself through legal means. Where do we go from here if that's the state of play?
I think the sovereignty issue itself, I think we will continue to stay, you know, to be firm about it. For example, we have told the Chinese and we have made it known publicly we do not recognize the 9-point dash as the boundary. You know, so I think on that we are strong. But apart from that, I think we just cannot afford to be confrontational on this issue. I think we have taken this position, and hopefully there could be a better understanding to resolve this issue. There have been a number of ideas how to reduce the tension, talking about some joint development. Now there is a cooperation on maritime, cooperation between ASEAN and China. Hopefully, I think some steps, small steps, should be taken to build up the confidence with China and also ASEAN, because technically, not all ASEAN countries are involved in this dispute. It's only 4 ASEAN countries. And to have an ASEAN position, common position, is quite difficult. And that even among the 4 ASEAN claimants, we also have dispute among ourselves, So this is something that I think we have to be clear and to adopt the right strategy and approach in working towards, some sort of a stable, to achieve a stable position in the region.
There's one, of course, concern, and it's come out in this expression, debt diplomacy, that basically China, through its economic heft, has been able to entangle itself with national economies and strategic and developmental plans to the extent that national governments are beholden to China because China is funding their development project. I mean, what do you make of criticism like that China's engaging in debt diplomacy?
It is something that we need to manage because we need to recognize the asymmetrical relationship between China and many countries. China is 1.4 billion, we are 30 million, China has the resources. So, the question of win-win situation have to really be worked out, This is where I think countries like Malaysia need to come up with our own formula, how to achieve this win-win situation, Of course, to me, it's not natural to have a pure win-win. There will be some areas that we have to give in, but there's some areas that we can also gain, given the differences of the nature between the two countries and between China and the world. And this is something not peculiar to Malaysia. I think the challenge for most countries today is how to manage a rising China. It's not to keep China away. It's not to actually divorce ourselves from the possibilities and opportunities that China can generate.
I'm speaking to Dato' Abdul Majid Khan, former Malaysian ambassador to China and president of the Malaysia-China Friendship Association. Next, we look at some of the superpower rivalries in the region, as well as how Malaysia might step up to the challenges that a rising China poses for the region and for the world. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, if you just joined us. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me is Dato' Abdul Majid Khan, former Malaysian ambassador to China and president of the Malaysia-China Friendship Association. Okay, now I just want to refer to some newspaper and academic journal articles that are coming out now. Foreign Affairs, which is, of course, well-respected, came out with an article, and I'll give you the title, "Is Beijing Adopting an Ethno-Nationalist Foreign Policy?" Interesting, relates to a South China Morning Post article, "A Rising China is Good News for Ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia, but up to a point." So this goes back to a time in the region's history when China was exporting its ideology of communism and funding many of the insurgencies in the region. And there was, in terms of domestic or national politics, the question of the loyalty of Chinese communities in those nations. And China at some point did pull back. Today, the prospect of China protecting its co-ethnics in jurisdictions beyond its own borders, is that something that is going to be a troubling reality of a rising China?
I would like to go back historically. You rightly pointed out the challenges that we faced in the 70s. It was ideological, it was the export of revolution. But our leaders then have the vision actually to engage China, even having these challenges. Actually, it was approached to mitigate our own fear, our own concern by engaging China. So looking back, actually, that policy has been very successful. See, when Deng Xiaoping came here in 1979, after we expressed our concern, he went back and actually dismantled the relationship between the Communist Party of Malaya and China. And hence, this allowed Malaysia and then the rest of ASEAN to have a full relations with China. So that challenge was well taken. You mentioned there will be also additional challenges now with the rise of China, with China becoming more influential. So I think for Malaysia and ASEAN, it's how to manage these challenges. There are a number of issues that you have mentioned, Chinese relationship with the overseas Chinese. My own understanding is that the Chinese knows the boundary. Because I think what they look for is the fraternity of overseas Chinese in terms of investment, in terms of technology, and in terms of the opportunities they can get. For example, technologies. There are well-qualified American Chinese scientists that have written to China. They have contributed also from Europe. I think the relationship would just be maybe along that line, you know?
But we did have this very interesting moment in Malaysia-China relations. We had the outgoing Chinese ambassador. He stepped in at a particular point during the Bursay rally some 2 years ago, I believe. Jamal Yunus, who led the Red Shirts group, threatened to cause some disruption in Petaling Street. And the day before, the ambassador went on a stroll. Now, this might have been a very modest gesture on his part, but a lot of people read into it as Chinese interference in the domestic politics of Malaysia. How do you read that moment?
I've been asked about this, and I think a lot of concern has been expressed. But I think as a professional diplomat, I'm sure the ambassador knows, the boundary and also what he should and should not
do. Did he overstep his boundary, do you think?
It is very unclear because the reference has always been, even to today, the support will extend to Chinese company, to Chinese national. And the Chinese have made it quite clear that ethnic Chinese who have become citizens of the countries, they should follow. And also they are part of that country, for example, the Malaysian Chinese, and they're not part of China.
Let's move to something beyond our borders, which is the American administration and how America views this. America has, for the last couple of decades or more, provided the security architecture that has provided the peace in Southeast Asia. Now they are being challenged by China. Do you fear that that China and America constantly rubbing up against each other in the South China Sea might end up coming to blows, that we might actually see the potential for conflict, especially with a White House that seems much more volatile and a president much more given to playing to the gallery in America?
I'm not that pessimistic. I think we should actually realize, U.S.-China relations is the most important bi-relations in the world. And I think while there have been, we'll continue to have strategic competition between the two powers, but we also must look at the cooperation, economic cooperation. The overlapping of economic interests between the United States and China are really deep. I think the leaders will have to take into account of this overlapping economic interests. They're very fundamental. So I don't think both sides are ready to actually disturb the current relationship, which actually have benefited the region and also the world.
you know, there are people who look at history and while they might not be natural pessimists, say that, you know, history teaches us that when you have a dominant power being challenged by a rising power, that and I'm referring to the book by Graham Ellison, the, you know, the Harvard professor, who, in his book, you know, Will, you know, China and America Go to War? And he talks about the Greek historian and theoretician Thucydides and what they call the Thucydides trap, that in fact, you know, more often than not, you cannot avoid this just because of the structure of power. Where do you stand on this debate about Thucydides' trap? I mean, can the Chinese and Americans avert war, especially when on one hand you have a fairly stable political regime in China with, you know, rules of succession, and then on the other hand you have a very volatile but democratic system that produces strange results sometimes. Sometimes people who might not be thinking of the long term with very short term views in terms of political maneuvering. Do you think that conflict is possible?
I don't think so. No, I think there will be strategic competition. Yes, there will be, you know, competition for political influence, and I think the competition could be very, very intense in the economic field.
Not in the political one. Look at Singapore. Singapore has positioned itself in fairly interesting ways, now coming up very pro-American. They have been chastised by the Chinese for their lack of loyalty on many in many ways. What do you make of that whole debacle between Singapore and China in this kind of shifting geopolitical landscape?
I think in managing our relations with countries, you know, each country has its own national interests. So I think Singapore, in so doing, think it is in their own international national interest to manage that way.
And for Malaysia, what it is? Is it playing off the two giants? Is it being friendly to both sides? Is it being softly, softly, gently, gently?
Yes, I think that has been our policy, because first we have to realise we are a small country. And actually from day one, we already adopted so-called equidistant relationship with all the powers. And this is also part of the ASEAN philosophy. When ASEAN was conceived, we have dialogue partners with all. That's why, you know, ASEAN is the most successful regional organization after the EU. We maintain relations with all. So bilaterally also, we managed to have this balance between the emerging, between the powers, especially between, you know, America and US. Both are beneficial to us, and each of them have their own strength that we can gain from. I think it's important for a small country to really manage the relationship in this strategic direction.
Lastly, Dato' Abdul-Majid, what would you advise us, not on the government-to-government level, but in terms of Malaysians, in terms of a people-to-people level, what would you suggest that Malaysians do when we think about China, its influence in Malaysia in terms of the economy, in terms of investments, as well as its politics? What would you have us remember? Yeah.
Well, you know, my association, the Malaysian-China Friendship Association, is established exactly for this purpose. We try to act as a platform for better understanding and also awareness and friendship at the level of people to people. We have programs, you know, cultural exchange, education, tourism, the youth. So I think to answer your question, basically we have to understand China. I think culturally, you know, it's a difficult country to understand. We need to understand its aspiration, its own dream. Because China was a power before. So what you see today, the rise is not just a rise, but re-emergence. China was the most powerful country in the 15th century in terms of trade, in terms of contribution to GDP. So today, we see again. So from our own national interest, we have to look that China is a close neighbor. We have a long historical, long cultural and trade relation with China. Admiral Cheng He came here in the 15th century. There is that legacy. So it's a much closer country, you know, that we have to manage and to maintain relation with.
Yeah, it may be worthwhile mentioning that you're also the co-founder of the Cheng He International Peace Foundation, I believe, based in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Welcome. Welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Abdulmajid Khan, former Malaysian ambassador to China and also president of the Malaysia-China Friendship Association. I'm Shahid Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.